This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, February 12th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner, Maya Coleman at the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from CAI's Mike Dean at the State House and CAI environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. We're joined by CAI reporter Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi.
And Morning Edition producer and reporter Sam Houghton is with us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
A lot of heat this week from local officials about the state's management of the vaccination rollout. In particular, the call for a mass vaccination site to be located on the Cape. Jeanette Barnes, the state announced two new mass vaccination sites this week, and that seemed to inflame local officials even more.
Yes. Senator Julian Sear talked pretty forcefully this week about how Barnesville County has the third oldest population in the country. And, you know, because of that age group here on the Cape, the Cape really is at the height of its need for vaccine now with the 75 and older group. And yet neither of the mass vaccination sites announced this week are on the Cape. They're in Natick and Dartmouth. Now, it may be worth mentioning that the state map of state-run mass vaccination sites only shows one in all of central and western Mass, and that's in Springfield. So other regions are driving too. But Sear points out that Dartmouth and Natick are actually closer to other vaccination sites that exist already than they are to some points on the Cape. Dartmouth is about an hour from Hyannis. But if you live, like obviously if you live on the lower or outer Cape, that's quite a haul. And Sear says he can't understand why the Baker administration hasn't asked Cape Cod Healthcare, for example, which is a huge hospital system, to do a mass vaccination site in Hyannis.
They don't have any answers for this. So in the meantime, the county is charging ahead here. Barnstable County holding two more clinics this week. One of them is today. They were offering significantly more appointments than in the last two clinics last week.
Right. So one of those clinics is today at the Little Creek parking area by Coast Guard Beach. A larger one it was held Wednesday at the Cape Cod Melody Tent. And they ended up this week having more than 1,700 appointments between the two clinics, which is a lot more, of course, than the 975 that they had last week. And 975 is also the number of vaccines that the county says they've been getting each week. So why the 1,700? I think people were surprised. And the explanation for that, according to Erica Woods, who's the deputy health director for the county, she says that the Pfizer vaccine gets reconstituted on site in the vial, and that when they do that, the amount of vaccine it makes actually varies a little bit. And so it made more doses than they planned for, so they held those over to this week. But on Wednesday, when they tried to do all those extra vaccines at the Melody Tent, it was a little hairy with the volume they tried to do.
Well, let me ask you about that vaccination clinic Wednesday at the Melody Tent. It seemed to be another learning opportunity for the county. They were scaling up. They did provide many more vaccinations, as you say, but there were some hiccups as well.
Right, yeah. Erica Woods says they did indeed overestimate their ability to do 1,300 vaccines at that site in a single day. So as we've reported, it was supposed to end at 4 p.m., but it ended at 6 instead. People were waiting a long time, and traffic was backed up into the street. Aside from the sheer number that they were trying to do, she said they had some other problems also. Some people showed up and said they'd been told over the 211 phone line that they had an appointment, but then when they got to the Melody Tent, they weren't on the registration list. So clearly that's a problem. Other people came with no appointment at all, just hoping there would be extra doses available for them, and that adds to the traffic as well. And then she also said people were arriving so early that they were kind of, they were sort of all arriving in this crush at once at certain times because people were arriving like an hour and a half early. So she said, please don't come more than 15 minutes before your appointment. Otherwise, it just causes more traffic issues.
Sam Houghton, you reported on the Martha's Vineyard vaccination rollout this week. The island seems to have a handle on getting the vaccine to residents 75 and older. Is that right?
Yeah. They expect to have the age group 70% complete by the end of this week and finish sometime next week. Both the hospital CEO and their chief nurse say they've been impressed with the vaccine team so far. Denise Schapisi, she's the CEO, and she, the quote we use from her is, you know, this is a well-oiled machine at this point. They've given out 2,300 doses at the hospital since the beginning of the rollout. And I did ask, you know, why they thought Martha's Vineyard might be ahead of the rest of the state when it comes to the 75 plus age group. And they had a couple of reasons. I think the first, obviously, is population. You know, they don't have as many residents on the island compared to, say, the Cape or the South Coast. But really, that's allowed them to handle all the vaccinations within the hospital. So they don't need these, you know, clinics held in regional sites like we just heard and kind of the logistical problems that come with that. You know, they said that does add a lot of complications. And also the hospital is, you know, just so if anyone has any questions, they are hosting a Zoom meeting tonight with the Dukes County government to answer any questions related to the rollout. So if you have any questions, that's today at 5.
Local teachers are pressing Governor Baker to give them access to the vaccines sooner. You reported on this. What are they saying?
Yeah, actually some news on this yesterday, I believe. The state's teachers union and a big state firefighter union asked Baker this week to make doses available for teachers right after the 75 plus age group. The first responders with this program would actually distribute those doses to the school staff. It's not clear how Baker's going to respond, but, you know, important to note here, most states in the country have prioritized teachers actually in the first phase of the vaccine rollout. So currently here in Massachusetts, they're not scheduled to get the vaccine until after the 65 plus age group, so not for a little while. And I spoke with a representative of the Nantucket Teachers Association, and they are saying they, you know, they want the vaccine as soon as possible. So after this 75 plus group, and their rationale is pretty simple. You know, teachers are exposed every day to lots of kids and in places that aren't necessarily well ventilated. So they're, you know, could get the virus, but they say there's an economic incentive as well. If teachers are vaccinated, the schools will be more likely to stay open in the event of a surge, and parents will be able to work. And, you know, important to note there's a concern on Nantucket, and we heard this from Martha's Vineyard Hospital officials as well. We are headed into school vacation next week, and that's bringing about concerns about a new surge in cases.
Jeanette, I want to go back to the Barnstable County clinics this week. There were difficulties for these even before the clinics took place, difficulties with the online sign-up process on Tuesday.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Some people who went on the website told us that they couldn't even see the clinics listed at all when they were scrolling through the clinics. Other people saw them, saw open slots, tried to get an appointment, and weren't able to get one, which, of course, some of that is just demand. But the county says the search function on the website is not too reliable, and they're now actually recommending that people just keep scrolling down through all the clinics until they get to the right one without entering any search criteria at all because of those problems. So for the clinics this week, the slots posted early Tuesday morning were full within about 45 minutes, but then this was like another little glitch when a second batch of appointments went up, I think, late morning. And the county said the reason for that is that the website, when you put up your hours of your clinic and the number of vaccine stations you're going to have, it automatically calculates the number of appointments you have. So it calculated fewer appointments than the county was planning to do, fewer vaccines than they had. And they added a second listing kind of later in the morning so that people could get those appointments. Now, in retrospect, kind of artificially adding more appointments may have had something to do with the big line that they had when they did it on Wednesday. So they're learning as they go, I think. But there were phone problems also. With the 211 line, the county got some complaints that the operators didn't know basic geography things, such as, like, someone who lives in Sandwich is not close enough to the Springfield Clinic to make an appointment there. So that was frustrating for people. And then, of course, as we mentioned, some people got off the 211 call thinking they had an appointment, and then when they showed up at the clinic had no record of it. So that's a lot of issues to fix or to work on.
Just incredibly frustrating, I imagine, for seniors trying to make appointments. They were told that these were going to go online Tuesday, and you could go online and try to find them. And you and I were on the website. I couldn't see the appointments. You could. We were, you know, looking at it from different places. It indicates how complicated this whole process is. It's really just these kind of difficulties that has prompted the four outer Cape towns to say that they're going to try to go their own way in vaccinating their residents. This is so interesting. Tell us about this.
Right. Well, the town health agents from the four outer Cape towns are working on their own system, they say, to sign people up for the vaccine. so, of course, we're talking about Eastham, Wellesley, Truro, and Provincetown. And they've been hearing from residents, of course, about all these problems. And the Truro health agent told me they can do flu clinics kind of in their sleep. You know, they have this experience and they want to apply that experience to kind of a local sign-up system for people on the Outer Cape for the COVID-19 vaccine. And she said it will probably be like people at a phone bank with a spreadsheet. So kind of the old-fashioned way, if you will. And they're hoping to do that before the next Outer Cape clinic, whenever that is.
Sam, the Barnstable County commissioners are also talking about decentralizing the vaccination rollout process.
Yeah, I think the idea here is that local towns, you know, will have their own vaccine. They have their own distribution plans from H1N1. So they should be ready to go with those plans once we get more vaccines. That's kind of what some county government officials were saying. And I think we reported this a little while ago, similar to the Outer Cape towns. And I know Sandwich, they were ready to go with their vaccines and said they could really easily get seniors booked, but they don't get as many doses as, say, the county. But I think once the distribution gets to be bigger, I think local towns will start to get those. That's what came out of a county commissioners meeting this week. And, it, you know, important to note, Sandwich, you know, they had practice when it held their own flu clinic in the fall. And I should also mention Barnstable County government is working with towns and first responders to help seniors that have not been vaccinated yet. We don't have a lot of details of what it will look like at this point or when it will be ready to go into action. But it seems like a big effort where you might have county and town officials actually signing up residents for vaccine appointments, helping them out and maybe even bringing doses to them when they can. But I think we'll more on that to come later, I think.
Trial court judges from Barnstable County had a message for the public this week. Jeanette, this had to do with how the courts are operating during this phase of the pandemic. Tell us about this.
Yes, so several of the judges were on a forum on public access TV this week to talk about what's happening at the courts and the pandemic and what's not. And really one of the main points they wanted to get across was that the courts are open. They're here for people, especially in emergency situations. You know, that courts often serve people who are in crisis or they're in time-sensitive situations like guardianship. And the judges said, for the most part, you can be seen in person if you need to in an emergency. A lot of hearings are being held over Zoom, though, and some of the courts specifically prefer Zoom, and they can do things on the phone as well. What's not happening yet are jury trials, kind of for obvious reasons, right? The COVID-19 transmission risk there, but some cases, some types of cases are going forward with a bench trial in front of a judge with no jury.
Before we go,
I was just going to mention you know, they also just kind of said, like, be prepared with some patience if you try to go into the court. buildings. You can go in, but you're going to be asked questions about COVID and so forth.
You can imagine what a complicated undertaking it is to try to run the courts in the middle of all of this as well. That's CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve.
And CAI's Sam Houghton. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Tisbury School is looking at temporary classrooms for housing students during what's still a potential building project. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us now to try to explain just what's happening when even the school committee and the select board are trying to figure it out, it seems. Hi, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
George, this is not the easiest story to set up. Why don't you jump in and explain what's on the table here for Tisbury?
So Tisbury is looking at a renovation and addition project, about $55 million. That still has to be approved by taxpayers. It has not yet gone before them. But you can't wait until taxpayers decide one way or the other to plan for what to do with the kids when the school is being renovated and added onto. And so that's one of the things that they're trying to deal with here. And it's a big question on the minds of parents. They really want to know what the plan is. So they were looking at a building that's vacant in Vineyard Haven, Educomp, but that negotiations with the owner of that building have not gone the way town officials would like. And so they own a building right across from the school, and that's it was considered a historic house, but it's fallen into such disrepair that the town building commissioner says it has to come down. Light bulb went off for some town officials and said, we can take down that building and put temporary classrooms over on that site. It's how to pay for them and the logistics of all that, because getting temporary classrooms to the island isn't all that easy, as it would be off island. So one of the things they're trying to deal with is how to pay for it and then when they need them. And they're saying that they may need them anyway because of if the pandemic continues into the next school year, they need additional classrooms to house students. But also, that school has had significant lead contamination issues, and they did do some remediation about a year ago. However, you know, they're still concerned about lead in the building. And so what to do about that? So one way or the other, it seems like West William Street, right across from the Tisbury School, will be the site of some temporary classrooms. Just how many, we don't know yet. And when that will happen, we don't know yet.
Hey, George, also in the paper this week, you have a profile of Dana Gaines, who put his time during the pandemic to the kind of use that could make the rest of us feel guilty. But thankfully, we can join him in his adventuring. Tell us about this story.
Yeah. So Dana Gaines paddled through the pandemic. He owns a kayak business on the island. Typically, he would have gone south last winter. However, the pandemic hit. He found himself on the island and didn't want to just sit around the house. So he jumped in his kayak and decided that he would venture around the island. He took 26 trips, traveled 213.7 miles, and paddled for 54 hours and 17 minutes. I'm getting tired just thinking about that. But there is a way for folks to have followed him at the time. He put this on an app, and you can even still go back and look at how he made his trips around the islands. And even the Martha's Vineyard Museum got in on the act and chronicled his adventures through some interviews with Dana Gaines. So, yeah, I can't say that I did that during the pandemic. I did do a few projects around the house, but paddling that much, that my hat's off to him.
That is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hey, George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
Supermarket employees are among the undersung heroes of the pandemic, quietly keeping the shelves and refrigerator cases stocked, checking us out at the registers. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with the story that some of these workers are now facing what you could say amounts to a pay cut. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, I guess the appropriate term here is a wage reduction. Explain what's happening.
Yeah, last year, Shaw's and Star Market and Stop and Shop both increased their pay rates, as you said, due to the pandemic. In March, Stop and Shop gave employees a 10% quote-unquote appreciation pay bonus. This was in recognition of the extra workload that the employees had in their role, both as frontline workers, sort of risking their health and staying on the job, and also in keeping the grocery stores open and stocked at a time when people were panic buying and there was, rushes to get certain items. That we all remember that. And in the summer, Stars and Star Market and Shaw's set a temporary base pay of $17 per hour, which they said was to help attract seasonal workers to keep their stores running on the Cape. And this was after the usual summer workers, the summer staff that they usually have, weren't available. Remember, the many foreign workers couldn't come into the country last summer because of restrictions due to the pandemic. But what we learned recently was that Stop and Shop had discontinued that 10% appreciation pay back in July. And that obviously upset some Stop and Shop workers. They reached out to Representative Sarah Peek, she tried to intervene for them. A spokesman for Stop and Shop said that the pay increases ended because the sort of demand, the run on the stores that they had seen at the beginning of the pandemic had dissipated and workloads were returning to what they termed their usual level. In a letter to the company, however, Peek wrote that, the pandemic not only continued after July, but actually continued to grow worse, and that the stress and fear and the risk that the workers were taking for their health and safety had not abated. She asked them to continue with that compensation and considered sort of hazard pay, but she said the company isn't regulated by the state at all, and they're going to do what they want. And they ended up not reinstituting that pay increase at Stop and Shop. Although, because Stop and Shop's workers are represented by a union, they were able to negotiate a payment 10% of their work hours for July and August as sort of a resolution to that situation. Now, over at Star and Shaw's, the workers recently learned that their pay increase would revert to their previous salaries. And for some workers, this means a reduction of as much as $4 per hour. A market official told us that the temporary increase had been extended twice and was due to end on January 16th. One Star worker that we talked to told us that a lot of the employees are upset and they're kind of scared that they'll be able to pay their bills on the lower rates that they're going to be getting just because of, and they're also worried because of they're still working during a pandemic. And, as we've seen, virus levels have started to come down, but they're still not at a level where many of these people feel safe. So it's been a kind of a roller coaster ride for these grocery store workers who many people have lauded for their bravery and willingness to keep coming to work through this pandemic.
Hey, Tim, we have a minute here, and I do want to just ask you quickly about the Coast Guard Boathouse, if I can. The town of Chatham has decided to accept this as a gift. We've talked about it in the past, but can you just bring us up to date on what happened this week?
Sure. Yeah, the select board on Tuesday voted to accept a gift of this historic Coast Guard boathouse that used to sit on the shore of Stage Harbor here in Chatham. It was used at one point to house the famous 36500 rescue boat. It was taken away in 2009 because the property was being developed. Long story short, it made its way up to Quincy and Hull and back to Quincy, where it's sitting now while local residents try to figure out how to get it back here. They wanted the town to accept it, to use it potentially as a new upwelling, shellfish upwelling building. And the select board at first was a little reluctant to do that, but this week they kind of bowed to the pressure. There's a lot of support in town for bringing this building back. They didn't commit to using it for the shellfish upweller, but that project continues to be discussed, and it's likely that in the next few weeks the board will decide what to do, at least temporarily, with that building. And it looks like it will be coming back to town, which is a real victory for preservationists in town.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Cape Cod's first recreational marijuana shop would like to expand, but the Provincetown Planning Board is not stoked about the idea. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner has this story. She joins us now. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Marianne, we're talking about Curaleaf, which has been open a year now. Tell us what's happening here.
That's right. As you mentioned, Curaleaf, their first store, they were the first adult marijuana recreational, you know, retail outlet on Cape Cod. They opened about a year ago in Provincetown. Their shop was really is in a basement. And I think they have like 11 registers there. So what they were hoping to do, and they continue to want to do, is to expand upstairs to a storefront and add, I think, 6 more registers there. The planning board ended up denying the request for a special permit to make that happen. The vote was 3-2. And Curaleaf is still figuring out whether they're going to appeal that decision. So they have until, I believe it's midweek next week, to figure out whether they're going to appeal. The one thing as I was thinking about it, it seemed like this expansion plan kind of brought out into the open some of the complaints that the neighbors had about the whole operation. So that's those complaints have kind of been more openly aired, I think.
Things like what?
Well, I mean, just the volume of traffic, cars pulling over right into like a loading zone, which was right there in front of the entrance. It was just congestion, with pedestrians lining up, just traffic, even people, there was a whole like a little cigarette dispenser. Not dispenser, but a place where you put your cigarette butts. And I can remember that kind of spilling over very early on. So there was smoking kind of right at the entrance, particularly with concerns about COVID. And also even the outfits that the security people were wearing were perceived as somewhat unfriendly. Hmm.
For much of this year, this has been the only retail marijuana store on Cape Cod. Curaleaf is kind of pointing to that as saying that was part of the increased pressure that the store has faced through the summer when they had traffic issues, as you say. But that going forward, they aren't going to have this kind of monopoly on retail marijuana.
Yeah, I think that's like their key argument. They said they have made some operational changes. They've added more people outside to help manage, you know, kind of the logistics of people coming and going. But the primary argument is that, and also they say that adding the storefront, another storefront there would help with the congestion. But their main argument is that when they were the only store on the Cape, that for them it was kind of the unplanned onslaught of so many people coming to the store kind of resulted in all of the problems. And their argument is that there could be even as many as 10 stores, you know, opening up soon. These would be retail marijuana stores. And even since they opened, there's one more in Provincetown that's maybe two or three blocks down the street. But that's really their main argument, is that it won't be nearly as crowded as this first year.
It is Mary Ann Bragg from the Provincetown Banner. And Mary Ann, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Maya Coleman of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. A road construction project 10 years in the making has come to a sudden halt before it's even really begun. It's on Martha's Vineyard, and Maya Coleman at the Vineyard Gazette has the story. She joins us now. Hi, Maya.
Hi, Steve.
Maya, this is the Beach Road reconstruction. It's got a pretty good price tag attached. Tell us what the snag is that's arisen here.
Yeah, so basically this is a state-funded project to reconstruct a half-mile stretch of road between Vineyard Haven and Oak Bluffs. And it officially broke ground this September after, you know, years of planning. And according to a project timeline, they were sort of supposed to begin preliminary work to prepare the road, but they've hit a couple of snags with the project that are forcing them to change course a little. And this is largely because the plans the state had drafted for the renovations were based on town records, and they've recently discovered a number of discrepancies sort of between those records and the utilities that are actually in the ground. So, you know, to put it simply, there are a number of water lines and pipes beneath the road that are in the way. And this has really maddened town officials who are unhappy with the snags, but also sort of the project more generally. And it sort of appears that the state is going to have to redraw a number of the engineering plans before they can move forward.
So anyone who's ever renovated an old house can sympathize with this, because you open up the walls and you go, what the heck did they do here? Who thought this was a good idea? So engineers are looking under the street and finding things that they didn't expect to be there, water mains and other infrastructure. But there are real time pressures here to this whole project. What are they facing to try to put this back on track?
Right. That's actually a really great question. So construction was sort of planned between Labor Day, Memorial Day for the next 3 years, with a completion date by about 2023. And, you know, it's not really clear if this is going to impact the timeline of the project. You know, in speaking to state spokesmen, luckily this was sort of a portion of the project where they weren't actually planning to do much construction. That was sort of slated to begin in March when the construction season begins. But, you know, I think it's not entirely clear if this is going to delay the timeline, and it's also not entirely clear if this is going to change or raise the expenses for the project either.
Just in the immediate future, what are they doing? They're trying to understand what's under the street level here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the state is currently in the process of digging these sort of test pits to continue to sort of investigate where the pipes actually are. And meanwhile, at the same time, I think the town sort of has concerns about the work getting done, and so they've subcontracted their own engineering firm that's on retainer with them and sort of brought them on to consult and look over the information, and that firm will be doing peer reviews in the future and I think helping to sort of contribute solutions and designs to the project going forward.
You know, for folks who may not be familiar with Beach Road on the Vineyard, this is a road that, like its name says, it runs right along the water, and that's adding some complications to this whole process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is sort of a central artery that connects Oak Bluffs and Vineyard Haven, which are the island's two port towns. But there have been a number of issues that have sort of complicated it due to the water. So one is that there's an area of road right near the construction project that has been severely eroding over the past few years, and the state has sort of, you know, done various nourishment efforts to try to repair it, but it really hasn't held. And so, you know, that's sort of creating more urgency for these repairs because it's delaying a lot of those pipes that are already underground. And then, you know, in addition, there were some concerns from the town over equipment management and road maintenance by the state in the construction area. And, you know, some of these issues have worsened some recent flooding in a storm a couple weeks ago. So, yeah, there are a number of other side effects as well.
The town officials are hopeful that they're going to be able to move forward now, though, on this and aim to keep it on track?
Yes, there's been, you know, no word of any delays at this point. And I think that's sort of part of the reason they're bringing in their own firm. So the timeline seems to be the same, but I think, again, it sort of remains to be seen.
That is Maya Coleman speaking to us from the Vineyard Gazette. Maya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Governor Baker announced a change in the guidelines for the state's COVID-19 vaccine rollout this week. People who accompany older residents to mass vaccination sites can now get a shot themselves. The move comes amid continued pushback on the way the vaccine rollout has gone in Massachusetts. CAI's Catherine Ident talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about the view from Beacon Hill on this and other state news. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
So let's talk more about this new change. It went into effect yesterday, and that is younger people can accompany those 75 and up to a mass vaccination site and also be eligible to get a shot.
Yeah, it's a system, they're calling it the caregiver appointments or companion appointments, and it's meant to encourage that 75 plus population to take advantage of the mass vaccination sites that have been set up around the state. Of course, Gillette Stadium is still one of the largest there, Fenway Park in Boston, there's some in Springfield, you know, one in Lowell, I believe. And the idea here is that some older folks might be intimidated by, a venue of that kind of scale. If your appointment says go to Gillette Stadium at 2:30, you might be kind of bewildered about getting there. So this allows a younger person to accompany an older person to go and get the shot and to get it while they're there as well. So the appointments need to be made online, and you need to attest on that appointment booking that you are there to accompany an eligible older person. And you're supposed to schedule it that same day as close together with the two appointments as possible.
And we've talked about this, we've reported this, there have been a lot of complaints about the way the Baker administration designed and then implemented phase one and now phase two of the vaccine rollout plan. And lawmakers have now been coming up with proposals of their own in the form of legislation to try to influence this rollout plan.
Yeah, a good example of this is four lawmakers, Senators Chang Diaz and Rausch, and Representatives Dom and Miranda, which geographically really takes up the whole state. They filed a bill to force the governor to address racial inequities in the way the vaccine's being distributed. So the bill they filed that's going to work its way through the legislature would force Baker to appoint a director of COVID vaccine equity to look at the disparities that are coming out, because they say if you look at the DPH data, and actually as we've been reporting as well, only 2.6% of those who've received the vaccine by the end of January are Black, and only 33% are Latino in that same time frame. Now compare that to the brunt those communities have taken with COVID infection and especially COVID deaths, and you see where this kind of inequity idea is coming from. But there are lots of bills like this trying to force the Baker administration to course correct, to do one or another thing, and it's really a question of whether or not they're going to be successful in influencing the governor in the here and now, rather than this bill becoming a law, because as we know, the legislature takes its time, and them jumping to a bill like this, especially when there are so many other similar ones, is kind of a long shot, because we're dealing with the vaccination window that's really only going to go through the spring and summer.
What about signing up for appointments? You know, we've talked about a lot of criticism with the website, and I know there was a bill even proposed a week or so ago to force Governor Baker's administration to open up a hotline for folks. And that did indeed happen. The bill did not need to become law. How are lawmakers feeling about the appointment system right now?
That was Senator Eric Lesser's bill, and that when he filed it, it got so many co-sponsors, half the legislature or more, signed on automatically. And that really sent a signal to Baker to get this thing rolling. That phone line was always kind of in the works. He has said he would have wanted it to launch when the vaccine phase two had launched. However, it wasn't ready yet. So it really lit a fire under the administration to get something like that done and finished and to show the importance.
What about a move from state lawmakers to force the Baker administration to build a pre-registration website?
This is, again, another example of trying to influence the gov, this time from Senator DiSoglio of Methuen, that would do what a lot of states have been doing. You know, Florida, West Virginia, New Jersey have similar systems like this that let you pre-register. So you go to a state-run website, enter your medical details, and it will tell you where in line, so to speak, you would be, and then kind of pre-register you for an appointment when your place, when your phase becomes eligible for the vaccine. Of course, we're still very limited by the amount of vaccine supply that's coming from the federal government. But this would kind of create an orderly queue virtually so that people could sign up, know where they are in the process, and make it easier that way out. So this is something that DiSoglio has filed. We don't really know how Baker feels about this, if this is something that's similarly in the works. He has said that he is looking at making improvements to that website, the appointment booking web map that the state has been operating the last couple of weeks. So this could be one of the ideas that gets adopted.
Finally, I just want to switch gears and talk about the election of 2020. Remember that? It feels like a long time ago, but I'm bringing it up because the provision that allowed for mail-in voting and day-of voter registration will expire. And Secretary of State Bill Galvin does not want that to happen.
Yeah, and I think many lawmakers share that they don't want that to happen. They kind of like how the 2020 primaries and then the election in November went. Like you said, the emergency law needs to be replaced somehow. Galvin's getting out front there, and he's, of course, the top election official in Massachusetts. He's putting his plan in place that would make mail-in voting permanent, and it would also allow same-day voting registration, the way that some states do, that Massachusetts has never had before. This would allow someone to, if they were going to vote in person, walk into their polling place, register for that election, and vote right there. It would do away with that 20-day window between the registration deadline and election day. That's something that advocates have been pushing for a long time. Galvin has supported it, but, the administrating it and getting it off the ground has been a challenge. And now he says now is the time to do that while we're also reforming how we do our mail-in voting.
And that is CAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us live from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks. Have a great weekend.
Great to be with you.
And that's CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. A new statewide report is urging fast action to address ocean acidification to avoid catastrophic effects on the region's shellfish industry. And CAI's environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff joins us now to talk about what the report recommends. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, start by explaining the ocean acidification. What's causing it, and why is it a problem for the shellfish industry?
Yeah, so the report explains that the first thing you need to know is that the world oceans are becoming more acidic. And that's because they're absorbing just massive amounts of carbon emissions produced by human activity every year. They absorb about a third of our carbon emissions. And then across Massachusetts, acidification is actually worsened by nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus that are released into the waterways, mostly through lawn fertilizers and septic systems. And so what ends up happening is the ocean absorbs more carbon emissions and more nutrient pollution, and it becomes more acidic. And when it becomes more acidic, it limits certain ions that help mollusks like scallops, oysters, and clams maintain their protective shells. It interrupts that process, so you're going to have far fewer mollusks able to survive predation, able to even survive in the larval stage.
Well, connect the dots for us from that to what the economic impacts could be for the state's shellfish industry.
Yeah, so right now, the shellfish industry in the state is worth $460 million. That's how much it brings in each year. And it employs, thousands of people, 5,700 people. But as waters get hotter and more acidic, the state of Massachusetts will be disproportionately affected by ocean acidification. And then when you, just because of how large our shellfishing industry, so then when you project out to 2100, so 80 years from now, the U.S. is expected to lose more than $400 million every year completely because of ocean acidification.
So when we talk about ocean acidification, it's really a global problem. How can the state of Massachusetts begin to tackle it?
Yeah, so the report authors are now recommending improved acidification monitoring along the coastline. They recognize that, you know, this is largely a global problem, but monitoring efforts are not enough. So they want that. They want to see a permanent ocean acidification council for the state and funding, of course, to research the economic and ecological effects. Like, for example, the report says it seems like crustaceans like lobsters are more resistant to ocean acidification than clams and scallops, but we don't know much about the combined effect of rising ocean temperatures and ocean acidification. They just haven't been thoroughly studied. And in Atlantic surf clams, horseshoe crabs, Jonah crabs, no one has studied the combined effect of ocean acidification and rising heat, according to the report. And also, I'll throw in there, this report is calling for legislative changes to update and improve nutrient pollution regulations. This is something we've talked about a lot on this program. That nutrient pollution, specifically from septic systems, is really affecting local water quality. We've talked about it in the context of fueling toxic blue-green algae blooms. This is yet another outgrowth of how unmitigated nutrient release into the waterways is going to really harm the region's water quality and way of life in turn.
I want to ask you about another story that you've been following closely. You reported this week that hundreds of Cape Cod residents emailed the Massachusetts Army National Guard over the summer to say that they oppose its plan to build a machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod. Tell us more about what the public actually said about the range. Those comments are now public.
Yes, right. So during that public comment period, 330 people emailed the Guard to say, we oppose the range. Lots of people in that group said they're concerned about environmental impacts, specifically on the sole source aquifer that runs underneath the base and provides drinking water for Upper Cape towns. And only 9 people, in comparison to that 330 who said we oppose it, 9 people said they support it. Another few dozen emailed asking for more information about the range, but there was just an overwhelming sense that the public of Cape Cod, who is engaged in this process, does not want this machine gun range here the way it has been designed.
These comments were released only after the Association to Preserve Cape Cod filed a records request. Kind of a funny thing to have to try to file a records request to make public comments public. What is that environmental group hoping comes out of making these comments public?
Yeah, and that's certainly how APCC feels. What they really want to see now is the State Environmental Management Commission, which ultimately decides whether or not to construct this, whether or not construction can happen on this range. They want them to take in the fact that 90% of the comments submitted over this range were negative and say, that matters. We need to really consider these as we decide whether this range is appropriate for Cape Cod. That is their big hope of getting these comments released.
That is CAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zukoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We spoke with George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner and Maya Coleman at the Vineyard Gazette. We heard from Mike Dean up at the State House and our environmental reporter there, Eve Zukoff. A big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio. Well, we've been talking news. He's been surfing the waves of the technical wizardry that make this show work. Thanks, Dan. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.